and welcome to the fourth. Welcome to an episode of the DefendoCast, where I, Lisa Schmeiser, will be talking with Tony Sindelar and Phil Mozeliak about episode number 4 of The Defenders. Like I said, Tony's here. Yay!
Hello, nerds. Mm-hmm.
And Moze is back. He's joined us again. Yay!
I was never really gone. I just was grouping up with another team for a little bit.
I just assumed you were busy killing people in the sewers in Bangkok, but explanation's more glamorous.
I was dealing with some stuff in Louisiana that just needed to be capped off.
Oh, that's right. Long-time fans or short-time fans of both the Flash Cast and the DefendoCast knows we usually start off with a nice zippy recap of what happened in the episode, and then we will move on to talk about weighty questions such as whether or not people are right to distress Matt Murdock, and does every episode have to have Sigourney Weaver swanning around saying "my child," and exactly how much Chinese food can Danny Rand eat in one sitting. So
what a woodchuck can.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no. So I love the detail, by the way. I look forward to cavilling about it in a little bit. So Tony, would you like me to count you down?
Sure. Episode 4. Yeah.
Episode 4. Let's do this. All right. Ready?
Yep.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
This is the Chinese restaurant episode where the gang spends the whole episode waiting around to be seated. Nope, that's another show. This is the episode where they are holed up in a Chinese restaurant trying to stay off the streets. And there's some quality squabbling because they're not even a team yet. The group has failed to gel immediately. So there's some infighting. Stick shows up to be kind of a jackwagon and drop some knowledge. Jessica basically bails because this is way too wacky. But she goes to continue her own solo investigations and is seeing lots of information about the hand and basically realize, I probably need to regroup with these people. Alexandra kind of shows up at the restaurant all ghosty-like and offers them some kind of bargain. She is very interested in Iron Fist, but that bargain is rejected. Elektra appears and looks very menacing, and Jessica Jones tosses a car at her. The end.
You did that in you did that in 58 seconds.
It's all that flash cast training. So
there we go. Excellent. Yeah.
Strong.
Yeah, it helps that I like this episode a lot. This is my favorite episode of The Defenders so far, and my favorite Marvel Netflix episode that I've seen in a long time, having watched a lot of Iron Fist and not being super into Daredevil season 2 and so on and so on. So this was like, this was what I was looking for, and I feel like I had to work a long way to get to this. But like,
it was a three hour ride to the destination.
Yeah. I mean, the brief recap, kind of what it doesn't give you is the fact that this episode has some great character moments and some really kind of funny writing and some kind of heavy info dumps. But yeah, this was what I thought I was hoping the series would be. And yeah, so I can get more into that later.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my favorite character development things is when Danny just kind of blithely buys the restaurant, for lack of a better word. He agrees to pay the rent for the next 6 months because they run into the restaurant and they're all like, oh my God, we need a place to hide. And Matt is listening to the neon and wigging people out that way, and Danny goes and quickly negotiates with the owners in Chinese, and what he agrees to is, fine, I will pay your rent for the next 6 months, and I will also order everything on the menu. And he just kind of does this casually with, it's good to have money. And then over the course of the episode, he basically eats his way through everything he's ordered. And it's just...
First off, let me just say this, that any actor that can act while eating, it gets a check mark of a plus. And I am going to renege. Not that I'm going to go watch Iron Fist again, because that's not going to happen. I'm not going to finish that.
Yeah.
But after watching this again, I don't have the same kind of contemptual, like, nastiness about Danny that I did. In fact, I kind of actually enjoyed him as... Seeing how he actually is the main thread of this entire plot line, I can, you know, it's like I'm giving him a little bit more forgiveness than I normally would, but I can kind of see where things are heading. And like even the dialogues between him and Luke which we know that's, you know, as a fan and as a connoisseur, we know that they're going to team up. And their relationship has to start somewhere. And yes, it's awkward.
Yeah. And like,
it's
so I think great. That's, I mean, I think he's written a lot more charming in this episode than he is in the entire Iron Fist series. So that's strong. And like, you know, it is, they're definitely playing with the fact that from the comics, like Luke Cage and Iron Fist are the like close friendship, right? They're the team up that gets their own title. And the show is kind of playing with the fact that like the depictions of these characters in the Netflix Marvel universe, like, they're coming from very different places, and like they're not going to be fast friends, and there's going to be some stuff they need to work through and talk about before they can be a team. I'm okay with that.
So what I really liked about the fact that Danny took so much relish in eating all that Chinese food is it hit me, that's his comfort food. Like the same way that people who are raised in California tend to regard burritos as comfort food, or somebody on the East Coast might be like, yeah, I need a big bucket of popcorn shrimp, or I need a big bucket of chicken.
It's just burritos. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
No, but I really liked that detail that because it's one of the few that has managed to successfully convey the idea that this Western child was raised in a completely different culture and still hasn't managed to like get it through his own beautiful golden thick head that hey, they do things differently in New York now. So I loved that Danny got some very nice characterization. I enjoy that Luke Cage is still basically the heart of the group and has somehow decided he's everyone's dad. Like, yeah. Luke Cage is the dad of the Defenders, where, you know, oh, you have a problem with my son? Well, you know, I will talk to my large adult son, but lady, this is family. You are not. So I love that. I also enjoy that Matt Murdock is holding them at arm's length and being held by arm's length too. It's interesting how prickly he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and,
I mean,
and I like his that.
I you know, like, mm-hmm. as okay, and this is like there's a couple wispy moments in this with Murdock, which is, and I'm not gonna, you know, say I don't have a soft spot for Matt, because that's gonna be further from the truth, but you know, he wants to protect everyone, and at the same time he doesn't want to be Daredevil, which is fascinating. And just kind of trying to say, you guys are way out of your league on this. You have no idea what you're up against. And in fact, that doubles down when Stick throws down the real information.
I just love the kickoff of the episode where they're all, I mean, we're coming right off the end of episode 3, where we have this giant kinetic fight. And you can see, everybody is still basically, like, high on their adrenaline rush, right? And they're all, reacting to each other. And, like, Matt is doing the thing where Matt is like, I am going to point out the creepy things I observe, even though that is not helping. Like, pointing out that I can hear neon, not actually helping. Pointing out that I
can see. And Luke is like, who can hear neon? Like, he's the audience surrogate in that moment. It's just so great. I love it.
And that, you know, I can hear that one's, or not, maybe he's smelling, but I can sense that this one is shrimp versus this plate of dumplings is pork.
That's shrimp.
There's a clear difference.
Yes.
Smell.
The way he matter of factly says it, no, it's shrimp. That one's pork. And what I like about that moment is like you said, he's being creepy and he doesn't realize it. Or rather,
and Jessica Jones comments on Danny speaking Chinese fluently, and I think it's Danny comments on Jessica Jones like flipping the giant armoire in front of the door, and like they're all kind of freaking each other out.
Wow, she's
and that's
strong.
Yeah. That's wow. Fun. It's just fun seeing them all bounce off each other, and then, you know, in that chaos, Jessica Jones and Luke Cage kind of get like a conversation, like, what's going on here? Because they're kind of the bridge, right? They're the two characters that actually know each other and have a relationship that goes back more than like 24 hours in real time, right?
And they bumped uglies, don't forget. Well, and again, this kind of goes back to Luke Cage as the dad of the group, because he knows what to do to keep Jessica from popping off and being Jessica-esque. And he's also trying to manage her like in a really kind way too. And eventually they'll all realize they have Claire in common, because that's going to have to happen. Like, Claire has popped up across all four series, and, you know, they're all, oh, you, I know you. What I love about this particular episode is it really shows that, again, Luke is the heart and possibly even, I'd say, the conscience of the group. And Jessica is the skeptical and investigating brain. And Danny is Danny.
And
and Matt is a finely honed survival sense. Yeah, Danny is maybe you could say that Danny is kind of a, I wouldn't call it sense of purpose, but Danny is the one who's willing to be like, come on, guys, we can do this. We're a team. We have a mission. And
right. He's acting as kind of a mm-hmm. lubricant to yes. everything and mm-hmm. trying to break some of this yeah. tension. And, you know, Matt's over the top trying to protect everyone.
Yeah.
And Danny actually sees the benefit mm-hmm. of bringing this team together.
Yeah. I think maybe this is why Jessica and Matt get along so well, though, is they both have this really finely honed, paranoid and guilty sense of survival. And so they're both like, oh, these two idiots, these two bulletproof, golden fisted idiots. What are we going to do now?
I love how each of them has their own little piece of the mystery. And they're all like,
yeah,
well, this is the thing I know. And then somebody else mm-hmm. says their thing. And they're like, that's garbage. That's unbelievable. Yeah. Right.
But nobody trusts each other.
My unbelievable thing is believable. Yeah. Your unbelievable thing and Jessica is extra sarcastic in this episode, which
yeah.
I love.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what are you, God. Lithium?
Oh, God. But she's got like the greatest entry towards the end of the episode because you see Elektra and it's very dramatic and like her hair blows back with a fan and the sword is seen and she's posturing and the dudes are all okay we can maybe live through this, and then all of a sudden there's a car and Jessica's like, ah, who missed me? And
I'm I like, love even before the even before her who missed me line, they have that shot where Jessica like walks out from behind the car and we see Elektra who is not like out for the count but is on the floor, and Jessica just gives her like a little like how you like me now head nod.
I know, like, I love it.
You know, let's just talk about something real quick. And I don't know if we broke it down early on, but it seems as though power levels have not been fully described.
And I think, especially as we get into, I think when we talk about season five, episode five, I have a lot of questions about that because they're all over the place.
Right.
Yeah. So part of the, I wouldn't say it's a problem, but what they're doing with Elektra here, or the Black Hand, as she's called, or whatever.
Black Sky.
Black Sky.
The Black Sky, that's right. Black Hand is my daughter's imaginary friend, I'm sorry.
Isn't that the name of the terrorist organization accidentally started World War One? Basically? Serbian Black Hand?
Yes, I used to ask what languages Black Hand spoke when my daughter would talk about him. but with Black Sky here, like, what we know about her is impervious to car crashes, apparently.
The car bumped her, right? I mean,
weirdly amnesiac in ways, and yet capable of functioning in modern society without too many weird gaffes, which is something that we haven't seen from anybody else. They've sort of written her in a way where, we kind of need her to fill in this plot hole, so here we go, she can do this, here we go, she can do that. And I have to say, I liked her a lot better in Daredevil, where over the course of series two, like, she realizes that she is actually the embodiment of a living weapon. Killing is the only thing that she really enjoys and gives her purpose, and she's horrified by what she is. And I know here they're like, this body, this vessel, the Black Sky, blurp, blurp, blurp. But if the conflict is supposed to be the body and the vessel to the Black Sky are actually having the problem with the personality of a woman named Elektra coming online, we haven't seen a whole lot of that yet. And I realize it's supposed to be a thing, because every time she fights with Matt, he's like, listen, baby, you know, you died. I can bring you back.
Whoa. Oh. Next episode.
You're right. No, but this, every time he fights her, he's like, Elektra, this isn't you. And, well, dude, you're a lawyer. Maybe look at the evidence. And writers, maybe show more of Elektra, the Black Sky coming to as Elektra, because I'm not seeing that yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll be honest with you. As much as I enjoy the idea of Elektra assassin and that character, you know, it's almost as if we're looking, I hesitate saying this, but it's almost like she's been put in as like an iron giant with a bolt in her head that, mm-hmm. you know, like a dent. Mm-hmm. And so she's not cognizant of what she is. And so she's really becomes this really oddball puppet, mm-hmm. if you will. And then the whole daughter thing, and it's weird.
She does a lot of standing around while other characters talk at her.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Which if that's what she is, I get it, but it seems like we want a little bit more because we've seen her act differently as Elektra. Granted, she's not Elektra, as everyone will say.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, you know, it's like, can you not talk for yourself? I mean, you're not just this wanton, violent girl.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to be able to communicate with some people here, I think, just a little bit.
Where should we go? I was going to say, yeah. I think with this episode, this is the end, then they became a team sort of mm-hmm. thing. You know, because it seems like what goes on this episode is Stick shows up and everyone's like, oh, God. And then you have Matt, who is at first all, I want nothing to do with you people. And this was just a one off and so on and so forth. And by the end, he's like, okay, fine. All right, friends, let's do the kung fu. And then it's the moment where they all decide, yeah, I'm working with these weirdos. And I like that you can see that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Alexandra appearing in the restaurant and, like, mm-hmm. trying to play head games basically kind of backfires, right? Because she's basically there addressing Danny because mm-hmm. they need the Iron Fist for something, and we can talk more about that. And she's, mm-hmm. like, it seems like her goal there is, like, to strike some kind of bargain slash put them off balance, and that basically completely fails because she ends up, like, tying them together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I guess she completely fails because they are now a team. Even though 20 minutes earlier, Danny is like, we're a team, and Luke Cage is like, don't use that word. I'm not looking for no super friends.
And Jessica's like, nah, no. And Matt is like, I would like to pretend this entire night never happened. But then the minute she comes in, she's like, the more ties you have, the more they break, and blah, blah, blah. And like, you can basically see like every defender in that room going, oh, screw you, lady. Like,
But that's what Matt was saying the whole time. He's like, they're not going to go after you. They're going to go after everyone mm-hmm. you love.
Yeah. No, I think it's they have enough of a contrarian nature, though, where I think when they heard her, like, instead of making them fearful, like, they already live in a state of heightened fear. So making them more fearful wasn't working. What it did is it made them mad. And we know from their characters that once you make them mad, that is when it's on. So.
When Alexandra got her body's failing her, mm-hmm.
yeah,
and mm-hmm. so she's going to go out on the town. Did I miss something that she got some phone call or something
mm-hmm.
That they were at the Royal Dragon?
It seemed like that was what happened. Yes.
Yeah.
And they showed her taking some pills. They also, in that shot, they kept, and I feel like I've seen this in a few other places, they keep showing her, like, in reflection from, like, a mirror in her, mm-hmm. and that's interesting, and I don't know where that's going yet, but that's, I have twigged to that as a interesting thing that they are doing over and over again with her.
Oh, just like her clothes,
by Tony Sindelar.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's just like the clothes. The clothes are another thing where you take a look at the colors she's wearing and you see whether she's in sync with her surroundings or out of sync with them, or in sync with her fellow members of the Hand or out of sync with them. Mm-hmm. Because that was one of the things I noticed, too, was she really stands out like a sore thumb in this whole, in all of episode 4. And what's really interesting is all of the defenders are kind of a unified visual palette, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did the two of you feel about Stick's info dump? It was a little info dumpy. But mm-hmm. like I kind of mm-hmm. felt like, you know, this was like Stick's trying to sell me on his role playing game that he wants me to play. Let me tell you about the background.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. I think I was willing to be more accepting of it because mm-hmm. we have seen so much of that. The Hand has been the background of so many things for so long that we've been building up to this, and it's like, you know, I wouldn't have mind knowing some of this earlier, and it's hard not to give us all of this because he tells us basically a story about the founding of the mm-hmm. Hand. And I was like, that's hard to dribble out. And in a way you have dribbled out pieces of it because we've met, you know, I guess at this point we've met 4 out of 5 of the leaders of the Hand. And we've mm-hmm. spent significant amounts of time with 3 out of 5 of them. So,
yeah.
The thing that was funny is like, I did like it. And I actually enjoyed Danny's rebuttal on that, which was, I've learned more from him just sitting down than any time at Kun Lun.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, they really didn't educate you very well at all.
No, Kun Lun sounds like a terrible place filled with terrible people who educate their young people terribly.
Discipline.
But I think it is discipline. It's very much discipline. But, you know, even if you're on the inside of something, doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get all the information. There are side players and bureaucracies at work. that, you know, so you're the Iron Fist. Mm-hmm. You have a particular set of jobs you're supposed to defend.
You think they would teach you about, I mean, and maybe they don't know. Maybe that information has been lost to Kunlun. I guess not, because Stick has it. But, like, they think that, you know, his mission is to defeat the Hand. You think they'd be like, okay, let's talk about the five leaders of the Hand and their names and their specialties and their fighting styles, and here's what you need to know, because otherwise you're in trouble because you're not so great. So, but I get...
How does Stick know all this stuff, though? That, you know, that's, well, the part that just...
And yeah. I guess we haven't mentioned that. I mean, he is the leader of the Chaste. He's the leader, right, of the Chaste?
The Chaste at this point. Down to him. Yeah.
So I'm willing to believe that because he's like the representation of Kunlun's army outside of Kunlun, mm-hmm. he's got more information than anybody else on this side of the mountains, right?
And you know, you make a good point about the Chaste and Kunlun's army outside of Kunlun is literally, what is in it for them? They don't get to go to Kunlun.
I assume that they're like, it's a cult, right? So they believe they're saving the world, and you know, I mean, that's kind of Stick and Matt's conflict, right?
And if you join a cult, and if you join a cult, you're certainly not in it for cost benefit analysis.
I mean, so, you run a cult for the money. You're in a cult for mistakes. So because that's the whole problem with Stick and Matt, right? Is Stick is like, I'm trying to save the world, and you just don't get it. You're so stupid. I can't persuade you in nice words because I'm a jerk. And Matt is like, I don't want to be involved with your crazy plan to save the world because I'm not sure if I believe it.
Yeah.
I just want to be in love.
Yes, with multiple women at the same time. What's wrong with that?
It actually sounds pretty good.
Yeah,
but,
you know. Exactly. Yeah.
New York is complicated.
It is. Yeah. It is. 21st century dating is very complicated.
Yeah.
I think a lot of Stick's monologue also comes down to, we have Scott Glenn. You know, we're paying him all of this money. Let's get our money's worth out of Scott Glenn, because he's Scott Glenn. And when he shows up on the scene looking angry and belligerent and sinewy, let's just run with that. So. Yeah.
But how dope is it that he's doing this monologuing and he just a little bit ago cut his own hand off?
I know. Right? How did
that's pretty.
How did he cauterize? How did he cauterize it? Or what has he done? And what I also enjoy is how Elektra's like not even remotely surprised. She's like, of course.
That's ninja skills. Yeah.
She's like, of course you would cut off your own hand and run away. Nothing surprises me anymore.
I'm just, you know, I would probably clean the burners at Colleen's dojo before I cook anything. Is all I'm saying. So.
Yeah. Oh, very nice.
Nice, that's one word for it. I am glad that we got a lot of Stick in this episode, and you know, spoilers, he sticks around a bunch in the next episode. You know, he's fun as kind of the fifth defender, and you know, he's he's the I mean, there's a like Master Splinter and Ninja Turtles, is his name is literally like a pun on Stick, right? He's the mentor,
right?
He's the one who actually has a lot of information and knows what the plan is.
I was wondering if we were going to get to a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle reference. I didn't think it was going to be in this episode.
I got another one.
I'm so glad it happened.
I love the Ninja Turtles, so yeah, I'm ready.
Are we talking Foot Clan or what? Where are we going,
Well,
Tony?
You know, it has to do with how they get away from the restaurant. So, but that's gotcha. For next time.
So because you guys are Ninja Turtles people, and I can therefore say this, my child, who has not had a long acquaintance with either ninjas or turtles, concludes that they're all named after Renaissance artists because, quote unquote, they are ninjas and therefore have to learn how to shade between light and dark.
That is way more a good a reason than what is actual, the actual canon. So
yeah, I mean,
it's incredibly deep.
Yeah,
it's like, wait, what?
You can headcanon that a little bit.
I think she's probably right to her school because she needs to get moved up a grade. So,
or have her stop reading because it's getting ridiculous, and maybe dull her down a little bit.
They have to balance between light and dark shades. So I was like, oh my god, do you think chiaroscuro is a fighting type?
That's a little too much reading. Maybe a little bit more dodgeball will slow her down. So
maybe. But you know, you have pointed out though that this is actually, like, if we had to go back through the episodes and do an episode by episode ninja count, this one is surprisingly low.
I think we should talk about this more with events in episode 5. I'm sorry we keep referring to that. But I have questions about the Hand's logistics, because they seem Like, I don't know. Did they? I don't know if this is a choice on the part of the people making these shows, or if we're supposed to infer something about hand logistics. But like, they seem to have gone from "we have all the ninjas" to "we are out of ninjas." So
yes,
and they just and the heroes mainly don't kill ninjas. So and many of the ninjas are shown as being like undying. So where did all the ninjas go? Because they seem to have a lot more like, you know, people in suits who are also ninjas and guys with guns. That was a weird. There's
Do you think there's just like ex ninjas who all moved to the ex ninjas have all moved out to the Bronx and they're like, I just want to live a quiet life where no one is trying to kill me.
No, they were all most of them were massacred at the end of Daredevil
the great
2.
Ninja culling.
Yeah, that was the culling, and so manpower and associates.
I just wonder if it's a lot
hard time feeling.
I just wonder if it's a lot cheaper to like. To get a stunt guy who's going to hold a fake machine gun than it is to get a stunt guy who's a martial arts expert. Because even in Iron Fist, there's kind of a pivot where it's like Madame Gao now just has a bunch of gun guys. And I'm like, what? This is the hand? Like, you know, I guess like you literally
also,
have a secret
academy.
Also, when
did Madame Gao start getting sighted people?
Yeah. They have a secret academy training ninjas, but sometimes they're out of ninjas. So I don't know. Ninjas are not a renewable resource. You gotta allocate them appropriately.
There's a lot of training that goes involving them. All right, you know this, and I know this.
I think ninjas are not a renewable resource. Is the episode title?
No, it's renewable, but it's like planting a tree. You got to put in 15 years before you can harvest. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, you've got to go into other avenues and other realms. Sometimes the back streets, and you know. Resource yourself.
And
you're talking about the long-term stewardship of resources also has me wondering, like, one of the chief sources of tension for the immortal people in the hand is they've run out of their magic powder that keeps them immortal. Like, they have been at this for how long now, and why have they not planned better with their resources?
You sniff a lot of that stuff. It makes you go goofy. Then you start getting into your own stash, and then you think,
I'm willing to suggest that you know, they've been training ninja armies for, like, a long, long time. And basically, everything's been going great for the hand in the background until, like, the last year. And now suddenly, like, they're not prepared for a world full of superheroes. And they're losing ninjas left and right. Things were a lot easier when there was one Iron Fist and he could only be on one continent at a time.
I blame the Avengers.
Yeah. As you should. Another thing is, though, is what we've learned in other MCU TV shows and in the movies as well is you had Hydra, which, by the way, the hand should have done something about or with, and all these other organizations like S.H.I.E.L.D. that were busy trying to make super soldiers of their own. Like, why did the hand not foresee that and either shut those projects down so they could keep the magic powder for themselves, or perhaps like subvert those projects so they could have an inexhaustible supply of ninjas? Like, there's just... This goes back to, again, one of the biggest problems with the MCU as it expands is you get these things that are really cool in isolation, and then when you realize that this takes place in the same expanded universe as, like, four other TV shows and countless movies and spacefaring Viking dudes and so on and so forth, you're like, wait. If there's this organization that's been around for thousands of years, why haven't they considered XYZ, or where were they during World War II, or any of that, you know?
Yeah, I kind of needed, like, a line in this episode where, like, somebody says, we need to call in the Avengers on this, or somebody, we need to go to somebody, and I guess anybody else could just say, like, we don't know how to do that, or we tried calling them and can't get through, or something. You know, I guess I was looking for the one throwaway line that says, like, this is why we don't call the Avengers 1-800 number.
To report a threat
to New York City.
And I'm trying to figure out the timeline too, because if those guys are off, if one of them said, well, God knows we can't call the Avengers, the last time they came in, they dropped an entire country. Then you're like, oh, that explains it. Like, that's how they did it with Ant-Man, is they had Hank Pym make all those dismissive comments about, well, we're not calling the Avengers because they're busy violating human rights and dropping countries. And I think out of all of the Defenders, the two who would hate the Avengers on principle alone are Matt and Jessica. Because as far as they're concerned, the best vigilantes are the ones that go below the radar and don't have to and don't attract attention. I would give my left earbud for, you know, Jessica saying something really disparaging about the Avengers and why this is not for them.
Oh, that Captain America.
You know,
so
yeah.
Yeah, her this is all my own things. Like, sometimes her snarkiness goes a little long way. And I'm like,
see, I love.
All right, so I'm going to be snarky, and then I'm going to go walk off, get my tie on, and then do a little investigating. Mm-hmm. I get it. And I understand. That's her. First of all, and then secondly, F the Avengers. They're boring. They're garbage. But I like the movies, but, you know, they came from awful pieces of IP.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I love Jessica Jones in this episode where, I mean, I think her sarcasm is a lot more fun when it has other people to bounce off of and when it's not just kind of her by herself. I mean, that Jessica Jones is not supposed to be a happy, uplifting show, right? So it's a little bit more fun when Jessica, you know, even her moment alone where she's fighting that hand operative in the street outside her client's apartment.
Does everybody know kung fu now?
Yeah. Am I the only one who doesn't know karate?
Yeah.
I do have a question between Jessica and Luke. Now, that relationship from Jessica Jones, that really didn't play out the entire season, did it?
No.
Something broke off with them, right?
She told him that she killed his wife. Yeah. And he was like, this is really a lot for me to take in right now. And we really can't continue to have a relationship because I can't even begin to explain why it's wrong. I wish you a nice life. Also, your actions indirectly set my bar on fire. So
you're hard to be around.
I'm going to give myself a timeout from you. I wish you well, but I can't be around you right now.
Yeah.
And Jessica was actually kind of thrilled by that because she's self-loathing and she believes in driving everybody away from her.
To fill in that context, because maybe you haven't seen all of it, Mose. The big bad in Jessica Jones can control people mentally and make them do horrible things, right?
Right.
So, I knew that's basically part of Jessica Jones's huge problem is she has done all of this horrible things against her will, people have gotten hurt, including Luke's wife gets killed because of.
Yeah.
I mean,
on the bad guy's orders because hijacks her brain and orders her to do it.
So it's not like she had any choice whatsoever, but she, you know, still feels guilty because, like, I mean. She is physically aware of her actions, even if she is incapable of controlling them when this horrible thing controls her.
So now, within the continuity, as I understand it, eventually they get back together?
In comics. I mean,
I would not assume anything in comics.
Comics don't include that connection between them previously. So,
I would assume that they have
with how they've written these characters this time that they could. Also, it seems like Luke and Claire are doing okay, right? So
right.
I mean, I would just assume with the comics they've taken a lot of the core DNA of the stories, but some of the details like interpersonal relationships are going to be changed significantly based on cast chemistry and plausibility.
Yes.
For example, I don't remember Jessica Jones and Matt Murdock getting along that well in the Marvel Comics universe. But from what we've seen in the two episodes where they interact pretty directly, like episodes 3 and 4, like these two are on a wavelength and they're never going to get together romantically because they'd kill each other, but they're simpatico. And so, you know, I think we'll see more interactions along those lines.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I feel a little bit better about knowing at least that to kind of, because I knew that they knew each other. I mean, I had seen enough Jessica Jones to know what happened with them slightly, like when they're getting together. But I knew that there had to be some sort of breakoff point, and it's like, we're not exactly simpatico.
Yeah, and like I feel like it's a pretty good place where it's like they can't be around each other, but like they know that each other is on the level and that they're powerful people, and you know, and maybe they wouldn't seek that other person out, but they know that they are a relatively reliable person. And maybe Jessica Jones is a little less reliable, but is more competent and hooked into things. So other things we should say about episode 4, you know, I'm enjoying, again, I'm only watching these as we go along. So I know you two have watched ahead. I'm enjoying the kind of building of like, they need Iron Fist for something. And I remembered back to an early episode where they talked about excavating something under New York City. And I am like in my head, it's like, okay, I'm reminded of in Hellboy, like there's basically, there's a whole mythology about Hellboy has like a big stone hand. And it's like, that's his hand is the key to the apocalypse. It's unfortunate for him that the hand is connected to him. And I'm like, this seems like I'm getting some similar things here where like, you know what? The Iron Fist is more important than the Danny Rand the Iron Fist is connected to kind of situation. Then maybe it's important that he be alive for the time being. But they need, mm-hmm. you know, the Iron Fist more than they need, you know, Danny Rand to be a happy, friendly member of any organization.
Yeah. Was this the time in which we actually start to learn? I know something comes up in the next episode, but that there were multiple Iron Fists, because I don't know if that was clearly stated.
Alexandra, oh, no, it's in the series.
In the previous episode, Alexandra mentioned that she has killed multiple Iron Fists.
That's right. Yes. Okay. That's right.
Assuming we take that as, you know, a legit truth that she's saying and not boastful, like, I'm going to get in your head thing. But, I mean, in my from reading the comics, there's the idea that, like, there's always one Iron Fist. So mm-hmm. I guess that seems to be the case also in this. And it's kind of, in fact, because of, you know, he got stranded mm-hmm. in the mountains. It is a freak unusualness that Iron Fist is not, you know, Asian, right? So.
Yeah, no, it's because they mentioned in the Iron Fist series that, you know, it's a position that's passed down from person to person. And like you said, Alexandra mentioned it here. And this brings up a really interesting thing in that Danny is, for better or for worse, the vessel of the essence of whatever makes somebody an Iron Fist. Like, it's the immortal Iron Fist, not because Danny Rand is immortal, but because the powers that he's currently channeling are immortal, right? And on the other side of that, you have the Black Sky, who, again, they make a whole big deal out of, oh, Elektra, we don't give a hoot that there was somebody named Elektra occupying this body. This body now belongs to the Black Sky. And it's interesting how thematically we've got that coming up, where you've got two people on opposite sides of a conflict where they've both been told repeatedly and explicitly that they're really just vessels mm-hmm. for forces that immortal people are using to play 3D chess with the rest of the planet.
It's a horrible realization.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's, you know, and I mean, they're both kind of chosen ones, but they're the sad version of chosen ones, right? Where it's like,
well, Elektra never had a choice, did she? Nope. I mean, this is the thing, is at least Danny decided that he was going to go punch a dragon and become the Iron
and
Fist.
And I think, I mean, but I don't know if they're going to get into that in the Iron Fist TV series, mm-hmm. but in the Matt Fraction Iron Fist, there's the whole idea that, like, Davos, who we meet in Iron Fist, he is the one, mm-hmm. like, I mean, not destined, but kind of handpicked to be the next Iron Fist, and Danny basically sneaks off and challenges the dragon without, you know, kind of the blessing of the monks, and kind of, you know, jumps ahead a line of Davos, mm-hmm. and that there's basically some bad feelings between Davos and Iron Fist, and in, you know, some version of the comics, Davos becomes like a supervillain because he's, you know, well, if I don't get to be the Iron Fist, I'm going to be the Steel Serpent, and I'm going to be a horrible, evil martial arts master. And you could maybe use some of that for the explanation of, like, that's why Danny doesn't know anything, because he was not supposed to be the Iron Fist.
I also like the idea of a supervillain motivated by spite, because that's like my favorite reason for anybody becoming evil is just meh.
Yeah,
I don't feel like
they mentioned in the show in Iron Fist that, like, the master of Kunlun is Davos's mm-hmm. dad, right?
Oh wow!
So, depends on whether you want a meritocracy or a royalty succession system in your ancient martial arts order. But yeah, Danny cut the line pretty hard there. And Davos is not going to be super happy about that. So,
yeah. Don't believe me. All right. So I think we've sort of bottomed this one out. We all really love the episode. It plants some seeds for the back half of the series, because with episode 4, we did close out the first half of the series. And we ended on the note where, yes, the Defenders, all of whom are motivated by anger and irritation and the firm conviction that no one else gets to tell them what to do, all of the Defenders are now the Defenders. So I want to thank you guys for talking. And once again, we had Phil Moselak back with us.
Yay! Half of the season's done, and we're ready to go for more.
We're ready to go again. And Tony Sindelar, thank you for joining us and giving such a great recap.
It was fun. Goodbye, nerds.
All right. Bye, nerds.